Welcome back to the exciting conclusion of the Andrew Jackson story. This is a three-part podcast. There are two parts before this one, so if you're interested in hearing the story in chronological order, I urge you to go back and check those two out. Otherwise, I'll do a quick recap for you. I'm glad you all decided to come back and listen again this week. As usual, my name is Nick. And on this podcast, we talk about all kinds of different historical items. Like I said, this week we're going to be talking about Andrew Jackson. So let's get started. So if you remember in our last podcast, we left off with Andrew Jackson being the military governor of Florida. He's hitting his middle ages by 1821, and the guy's already proven himself to be a massive legend. He's proven his credentials in the courtroom, in the Senate chamber, as a judge, and in our last podcast, we heard about how he proved his credentials on the battlefield as well, rising from the rank of colonel in the Tennessee militia to major general in just a few short years. But one thing that we didn't really get into quite yet that I think deserves a little bit more emphasis is on Andrew Jackson's fiery temper. Now, when I was in third grade in elementary school, there was this teacher that everybody knew about because he had this very particular physiological thing that would happen to him whenever he would get really angry. So kids in his class would sometimes try and make him angry just so that they could see this happen. And what would happen was, when he would get really super angry, his face would turn a shade of almost kind of sickening green. Just like the Hulk, now that I think about it. The guy was just a little bit like a kind of a scrawny Hulk that wouldn't really grow at all. He would just get really impotently angry. But it really didn't matter, because to some kids, it was just terrifying. To others, it was hilarious. But he would just get so angry over the slightest little thing. And I can only imagine how much more terrifying his green, angry face would have been if he had had sword slashes on it, just like Andrew Jackson did. Those sword slashes, by the way, if you missed the first episode, he received from being insolent to a British officer when he was captured as a courier at age 13 during the Revolutionary War. Now, I apologize because I'm doing this out of chronological order, but I think it's worth modularizing, so to speak, this particular part of Andrew Jackson's legacy, because there's just a little bit more to it that kind of deserves its own angle. So one of the things that Andrew Jackson is most famous for, I think, is his temper and what would come out of that temper. And what would come out of that temper is a string of duels that he's pretty well known for. Now, this podcast would absolutely not be complete. Any source of information about Andrew Jackson would not be complete without getting a little bit into these duels. Because people kind of know that he was in duels, but really don't know too much about the duels that he was in or what led up to them. So let's get into that. So his first duel came in 1788. In 1788, Andrew Jackson had a duel with a man named Waitstill Avery. And Waitstill Avery was a rival lawyer of Andrew Jackson, who, as the story goes, was dynamite in the courtroom. One source that I was actually able to find on this whole exchange between Waitstill Avery and Andrew Jackson says that Waitstill Avery had this habit in court of saying, "I refer to Bacon," where he was actually referring to a law text written by the famous Francis Bacon. And Jackson got into Waitstill Avery's saddlebags that he kept on his horse, and he kept his law texts in that saddlebag. He actually got into that saddlebag and replaced Avery's copy of his Francis Bacon law text with just an actual side of bacon, the food, bacon. And that following day in court, Avery then criticized Andrew Jackson for his humor in court, which didn't really sit well with Jackson. So the two men set a time and place for the duel. They both got there, and then they just both kind of agreed to fire their shot at each other, but they were going to both intentionally miss, which is exactly what happened. And then that whole duel basically just ended with the two agreeing that they weren't going to kill each other, and they just moved on. The next duel that Andrew Jackson would be involved in happens in 1803, and he has a disagreement with a governor, a man named John Sevier. Sevier was the governor of Tennessee at that time, and there was some corruption charges kind of flying back and forth that Andrew Jackson felt that Sevier was involved in. Apparently, Jackson went in to try and find some documentation, to which Sevier did not provide, and Jackson just kind of saw that as evidence that Sevier was involved in this whole conspiracy. So that too ended in a challenge of a duel from Jackson. Again, they set up a time and place, and Jackson gets to that place, and he's waiting for Sevier to get there. And accounts vary on exactly what happened here, but it's clear that Sevier didn't make it to the spot in time. He actually got held up. And so Andrew Jackson decides he's going to leave, and on his way back on the same road that Sevier was taking to get to the place, they both meet. There's a bit of an argument, and John Sevier's weapon goes off, his horse takes off, and the weapons are gone as well. So Andrew Jackson pulls a pistol. This is just one of the accounts. He pulls a pistol, chases John Sevier a little ways. John Sevier runs, he hides behind a tree. So in any duel, there are two men that are doing the duel, and then there's another two men that are sort of diplomatic representatives for the two people that are actually going to be shooting at each other. Those men are called the seconds. And so the seconds for both John Sevier and Andrew Jackson get together, they kind of make an arrangement, and the duel kind of doesn't really go off. They just kind of part ways and nobody shoots at each other. So Jackson's next duel would take place on May 30th of 1806, so just 3 years after his last duel with John Sevier. This duel would be between Andrew Jackson and another man named Charles Dickinson. Now, if you look up a biography of Charles Dickinson, you're going to notice that one of the things that he's credited with is being a duelist. So he's another one of these guys like Andrew Jackson who did duels almost for the sport of it more than anything else. And he was also an attorney. That was his primary job. The duelist thing is really more of a hobby. It was a side gig he had. There was really no money involved. Again, it was just for the sport. It was just for fun. You know, you just shoot at people just for fun. That's a common thing to do, right? And so this disagreement between Jackson and Dickinson starts over a bet. Apparently, a third party who wasn't even involved in the duel had almost reneged on a bet, and then there were some rumors that were flying around, started by Jackson and the other party who was named Irwin. This Irwin guy's son-in-law gets involved, who was Charles Dickinson. And a very public shaming of one another begins to happen between Jackson, Irwin, and Dickinson. The story goes that there are ads taken out in the paper to basically hurl insults at one another. And this whole disagreement kind of culminates in a face-to-face confrontation at a place called Wynn's Tavern. And, you know, some words get thrown around. Maybe there's some drinking going on, perhaps. Somebody gets called a stupid meddler. Another guy gets called a coward. And suddenly you have a challenge for a duel. So, once again, a time and place is set for the duel. But Jackson's no dueling fool. He knows he's outmatched by this Dickinson guy, so he kind of comes up with a strategy this time. He packs on a bunch of heavy clothes before he goes out here to the dueling site. And his plan is he's going to let Dickinson take his best shot and just basically hope that he doesn't get killed by it. And then Jackson's going to take his time and take his shot. And that's exactly what he does. They both get to the field. They do their paces. Dickinson levels his pistol. He takes his shot and he hits Jackson in the chest, missing his heart by just 1 inch. But Jackson doesn't move. He stands there like a brick wall, staring down Dickinson until he's ready to take his own shot. So then Jackson points his pistol, takes his shot, and kills Dickinson. Dickinson falls to the ground, and that's the end for him. In fact, this bullet is so close to Jackson's heart that he would never be able to have it surgically removed. It was just too dangerous, so he spent the rest of his life with that metal in his chest. Talk about a badass. That time, the infection alone killed many men, but not Andrew Jackson. So that's the kind of guy you're dealing with now. So we'll get back on track now. We're going to skip forward to the year 1824, and there's an election going on. Andrew Jackson, as we had said before, had started to compile this list of achievements, and he was ready now to turn that on a campaign that he had hoped would win him the presidency. Jackson had already been elected as a senator again by the time 1822 rolled around, so he was sitting in that position when he was ready to run for the 1824 presidential election. He was nominated in 1822, which is the same year he was elected to the Senate, but the election didn't really go his way. He ended up losing, but he didn't give up on his presidential aspirations. So he waits his 4 years looking ahead to the 1828 election. He resigns from his office in 1825 from the Senate, and this election gets really dirty. A lot of people like to sit around and kind of lament about the mudslinging that happens in elections these days. But the insults and deprecations that you see thrown around today are so much less than they were in 1828. Right off the bat, one of Andrew Jackson's competitors calls him a jackass. And he actually kind of likes that moniker for a while. He uses it in his campaign until it kind of wears out. The association of jackass with the Democratic Party, which is what Andrew Jackson was running as, would get picked up again later by Thomas Nast in his famous political cartoon that characterized the Democrats as donkeys and the Republicans as elephants. But being called a jackass was not the worst thing that had happened during that very, very dirty fight of 1828. So again, the presidential campaigns that we see these days are, you know, they're not admirable most of the time, but at least they're not like the one in 1828. You see, we kind of have these unwritten rules that say that you should never, ever bring in another man's family into a campaign. You don't talk trash about their kids or their wives or husbands if that happens sometime in the near future. You don't talk trash about their kids. You don't talk trash about their spouse. If you're going to have a criticism, you should place it upon the person running, and that should be it. It was not so in 1828. One of the other men running for political office at that time calls Andrew Jackson's wife a bigamist. And that accusation was actually somewhat true. You see, Andrew Jackson's wife, Rachel, actually had married Jackson before that she had finalized a divorce with her other husband. But that's still not really the kind of thing that you want to say to a guy who's well known for his penchant for dueling and still has a bullet in his chest. Not something I would do. But even though the campaign was dirty and Andrew Jackson had lost the previous election, this time he was successful. But tragedy would once again rear its ugly head in Jackson's life, striking between the November election and his inauguration later in January, with the death of his wife, Rachel, who was buried on Christmas Eve. And even though for a guy who should really be used to this by now, somebody that maybe would try and be a little bit more reserved about keeping close ties in his life, considering how many people he's lost throughout his life, the death of his wife, Rachel, really struck him deeply. And I don't mean for that to mute the feelings that he had about the loss of his wife when I say that that following election he would earn another nickname, King Mob, for the notoriously crazy inauguration party that he had, with people coming in with mud all over their boots, coming into the White House, and such a large party, people were standing on chairs to get a look at him, and things were broken. They actually had to lure people out of the building. There were so many people coming in for the celebration. They had to pour punch into wash tubs out in the lawn. But then he would go on to campaign again in 1832. He would win a second term. And then in 1835, he would have an assassination attempt as he was leaving the Capitol building. A man caught him off guard as he was walking out, pulled a pistol, shot at Andrew Jackson. The pistol misfired, so the guy has a second pistol ready. He pulls it, fires, and it also misfires. So two misfires. Andrew Jackson is not hit by anything. But what he does do is he pulls out his cane and starts just beating this guy's ass with it. In fact, Davy Crockett is there and helps restrain the guy, I assume, as Jackson is wailing away at him. This whole incident would have people thinking that Andrew Jackson had survived by divine providence. And I'll admit that it is a little odd for two pistols to misfire, but apparently historians claim that humidity probably had something to do with it. We're talking flintlock pistols, after all. Even the slightest bit of moisture can throw those things into malfunctioning. But again, even in response to this assassination attempt, you see people saying and doing things that just wouldn't be acceptable today. The New York Times had actually even published a letter that said that people were grieving that the ball of the assassin did not perform its office. I mean, that's a pretty tasteless thing to say about somebody who just had an assassination attempt, that they wished that he had actually been shot. I don't really have a taste for that. Even if you didn't like the guy, that's kind of not something that you would really, that would really be an acceptable thing to say. And again, as a testament to just how politically charged this whole time was, it was also noted by the Times that within 2 hours of the assassination attempt, they had been able to connect almost every politician in town, as if any of these men had anything to do with it. The would-be assassin, Richard Lawrence, was actually just an unemployed painter who blamed all of his financial problems on Jackson. He'd also later be interviewed by some doctors who basically said that he was crazy and diagnosed him with painter's colic and paralysis. What does that mean? I don't have a clue what that's supposed to mean, but they're the doctors, right? I hope I don't get painter's colic. In any event, Jackson would retire to the Hermitage in 1837, where he'd live out the rest of his days, until June 8th of 1845, at the age of 78, when he would succumb to heart failure. And just one last note, Andrew Jackson would live his entire life believing firmly in this idea of the Union. He'd once be quoted saying, "I will die with the Union." So he really felt strongly about keeping this unified government, this unified country, and ends up serving as a prelude to the conflicts that generations in the very near future would end up having to deal with. Hopefully you learned a little bit something about him out of this. I know I did. I knew that he was a pretty interesting character. He's one of those alpha types that we kind of look up to just because it's so insane the stuff that he's credited with doing. And while there may be some exaggeration here or there, most of this stuff was really possible because of the landscape of early America. Hey, I hope you all really enjoyed this three-part series on Andrew Jackson. I know I had a really great time putting the content for this together. I put a lot of effort into it. And the fact of the matter is, this guy has got so much more to him than I could really get into in a sensible time frame, so I really encourage you all to take a couple minutes and dig up a little bit about him. I encourage that with any of these topics. If you're interested in history the way that I'm interested in history, or even if you find these podcasts entertaining, always keep in mind that I can't get into all of the extremely granular details on every single topic. All of these topics deserve a little bit more attention, and so if you're interested in history, even at all, I really encourage you to take a little bit of time and go out there and try and learn just a little bit more about it. Stretch your boundaries. That's my motto, my new motto. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, or you want to just leave some criticism, tell me how terrible a speaker I am or anything like that, feel free to do so. My email is nick@geekdonhistory.com. Or you're welcome to check out our blog at geekdonhistory.com. And if you're really enjoying the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe and to rate us on iTunes. I know I'd really appreciate that, and it would help get the word out about the podcast. Hopefully you'll join us next time. And as usual, stay geeky.